from KXJZ in Sacramento. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Once a dining rest stop between the Bay Area and Tahoe, Sacramento now has a lively restaurant scene. Two food critics give us local restaurant trends and tips today on Insight. So today, a Sacramento magazine has a high-profile new editor. Jeffrey Young was a founding editor of Macworld magazine and co-author of a controversial biography of Steve Jobs of Apple Computer. Young is now editor-in-chief of Prosper magazine. Coming up, we'll talk about Steve Jobs and Apple, as well as how Prosper now plans to navigate through the challenging world of the Internet. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, we'll take a close look at Sacramento's dining scene. Which are the places to go to? Which restaurants are heading up and which are heading down? Two local food critics will give us answers. First, Sacramento's Prosper magazine has hired a top business journalist as its new editor. Jeffrey Young's previous assignments include reporting for Forbes and The Hollywood Reporter. He was also a founding editor of Macworld magazine. Young's book credits include Icon Steve Jobs, a 2005 biography of the man who heads Apple Computer and, at the time, Pixar Animation Studios. Jobs disapproved of the book and banned every book by its publisher from being sold at Apple stores. Jeffrey Young is in our studio. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Why did Steve Jobs dislike your book?
I think he just likes to control everything. You know, and when you're a media figure like Steve Jobs, you can get away with that. And because he likes to control everything, and he couldn't control this book, he took exception to it. And I from my research into what happened, it was more of a who will rid me of this man kind of moment rather than a specific hatred of me. I've known Steve for more than 20 years, so I don't think it was that. I think it was just one of those kind of unfortunate circumstances where his lieutenants decided to go a little further than they should have.
And did this help or hurt your book?
Oh, it absolutely helped my sales of the book. It hurt a number of authors. What upset me about it was that there are a number of computer book authors who spend a lot of time trying to eke out a living writing about computers such as the Macintosh. And by banning the sales of their books inside Apple stores, I think, you know, he was sort of attacking me in a misguided manner. But that's the way these things work out. It was to my advantage. The book turned out to be a bestseller all over the world, in fact. In fact, it sold more copies outside the United States than it did inside the United States, which was pretty incredible and a real evidence of the global economy, I think.
When you look at the cover of the book, the letters CON really stand out. Why did you call it Icon, which could be interpreted negatively depending on how you read it?
Well, it was really a play on iPod. The original title of the book was Icon, spelled the normal way with a capital I and a lowercase C-O-N, you know, sort of referring to his role or his position as an icon of industry or an icon of technology. And at some point along the way, we all thought, wow, wouldn't it be funny if we made it into sort of an iPod-like word and turned it an icon? There was absolutely no effort to make any kind of allusion to him being a con man, and there's no reference to that in the book itself. So it was amazing to me when that was brought up, and in fact it was brought up to us after the book came out, and that may have played a role in his dissatisfaction, but it certainly was not our intention. In fact, the book is quite complimentary about Steve, especially his second coming. The book, you know, has a wonderful trajectory, dramatic trajectory, which is that, you know, when he was 30 years old in 1985, he was bounced out of Apple. And
the company that he helped found.
Right. Ignominiously, in fact. You know, he tried to foment a coup against John Sculley and was thrown out. And at that point, he was really at the bottom and wandered in the wilderness for a number of years with both Next and Pixar. Pixar was not originally a success. Pixar's original business was trying to sell $150,000 computers, of which they sold one with a sales force all over the country to do digital imaging. And they eventually figured out how to make animated movies, and Next was sold to Apple. And, you know, from there on, the story became a wonderful success story. So it has a wonderful arc. And the subtitle of the book is The Greatest Second Act in Business History. And well, I think that really is.
Well, notwithstanding the successes that Steve Jobs did have earlier in his career, what took him so long to get things together to make such a success of Apple the second time and to make such a success of Pixar once he changed its focus?
Well, I think it takes, you know, you have an arrogance. I think many of us have an arrogance when we're young, especially those who are very successful when they're young. And you think that it's all your work and that you are infallible. I think what happened with Steve was that he had this meteoric success as a young man and then went out and realized he didn't quite replicate it again at Next or at Pixar. And that develops a kind of humility, I believe. And I think that's what he reflected when he returned to Apple. For instance, the iPod is a product that Apple could never have produced in the pre-Steve's return days. Apple believed in itself and believed that it always had to reinvent itself, that everything had to be built at Apple. The not invented here syndrome was very important at Apple in the early days. The Macintosh took 5 years to be developed. The iPod was a completely different beast. It was a product that was cobbled together rapidly. It was built from a design from a fellow who came in from outside. They used off-the-shelf parts. And I think all of those are very key lessons that Steve's humility allowed him to partake of. And so that's why I think the iPod was so successful. And I think that humility is what really was the difference between the early Steve Jobs and the mature man who's there now.
What did Steve Jobs contribute to Apple in the early days? Because the conventional wisdom is that the other co-founder, Steve Wozniak, was the real computer genius. What exactly did Steve Jobs do?
Passion and a determination to succeed. Steve was driven and absolutely relentless about high quality and about making something happen. He refused. There are some wonderful stories about Steve having to do with the original plastic molding in the Apple II, and that it just wasn't good enough for him. He sent it back to a big plastic, you know, manufacturer time after time after time to make sure that it looked just the way he wanted it. He wanted it to look like the stereos that were on the shelves back then. This is the late 70s. The home stereos, like KLH stereo systems. He wanted it to look that good. Nobody in the computer industry had ever thought about that. They didn't care if it was in a metal box or there were wires sticking out of it, but not for Steve. It had to look right. It had to be, and he was relentless about it. Also, he was extremely knowledgeable, and it's forgotten. He was extremely knowledgeable about parts, electronic parts. He grew up in Silicon Valley and worked at the premier wholesaler of parts at that time. It was a company called Haltech. He knew what DRAM chips were good and which ones were bad. He knew which circuits were the ones to buy, and he knew what they should cost, which is even more important. One of the great comments about Steve in the early days was that he would call up suppliers and tell them, you'll just have to sharpen your pencils, meaning you better give me a better price than that.
Jeffrey Young is the new editor-in-chief of Prosper magazine. He's a longtime business journalist and author. He was a founding editor of Macworld magazine, and he wrote Icon, a biography of Steve Jobs, one of the founders of Apple Computer. In the book, you tell the story of how the Jobs family methodically approached buying a washing machine. Could you tell us that story?
It's a wonderful story. It's you know that they've introduced in the last few years European-style washing machines to the United States, which are front-loaded. Now, the United States has always had top-loaded washing machines, but these front-loaded ones use less power and arguably do a better job of actually cleaning the clothes. Now, in most families, I don't think that it would take very long for you to decide whether you would buy a new washing machine or not, especially if you're a billionaire and, you know, it's not an issue of finances. It's just a question of what washing machine shall we buy. But Steve likes to talk about and has talked about how in his family they spent weeks debating this, the whole family, his 7-year-old son, his wife, everyone, his other two children, his two younger daughters, all of them would talk about the pros and cons of what kind of washing machine to have, what it should look like, and, you know, which one they wanted to have in their home. And that's an incredible level of detail that I think most of us cannot relate to, but I think that's what makes him a different kind of person and a successful person. And it's that people ask me many times, well, how could I be like Steve? How could I do that? And frankly, I don't think most of us could. I think that's what separates him and people like him from the rest of us. They have this level of attention to detail that the rest of us can just imagine.
If things had gone differently, I guess Apple Computer could have dominated the software industry in the way that Microsoft does today. Do you think Steve Jobs regrets the fact that Apple did not manage to make that happen?
I don't know that he regrets it. I think there's certainly some competitive fire between Steve and Bill Gates, and it's been there for a long, long time. The two men are exactly the same age. Bill is clearly way more successful in terms of the world and in terms of his finances than Steve. But Steve's had the last laugh now because Bill was never able to produce a consumer product. Well, arguably the Xbox, but never really produced a product that people loved. Apple has been able to produce a product that people love. First, the original Macs, which had a fanatic following, and now the iPod, which is really fanatically loved by people and used. And so I think that Steve has the final laugh here. I think Steve is enjoying his dominance over Bill. In fact, one of the old comments that was given to me back in the early Macintosh days was that Steve used to like to invite Bill down to Cupertino and then slap him around a little bit to show him who was boss. Those were in the days when the Apple II was the dominant computer. Well, then Steve got bounced out of Apple, things changed, Bill became the dominant force. And now I think that the world has gone back the other way. Steve is considered the real visionary. And there are very few people who've changed three industries. Steve has changed computing, movies, and now the music industry. That's pretty powerful stuff.
When Steve Jobs was away, Apple almost went bankrupt. What do you think would happen if Steve Jobs were to leave today?
I think it's an excellent question. In fact, I think that's one of the most treacherous areas for Apple. I remember he had a bout with cancer a few years ago. There is no successor in place. In fact, all of his senior executives who were there in the day of when the iPod was built have left now. So there really is no, I think there's a real question as to what would happen if Steve weren't there. I think Apple would be in trouble. Steve is, and in fact, that's one of the reasons I think it's interesting, this whole options issue that's been raised over the last few years, is that, you know, Apple does not want Steve Jobs to be thrown out because he backdated some options. And Apple's trying very hard to make sure that doesn't happen. And I think they could be in deep trouble if he weren't there.
Do you use Macintosh computers or other Apple products yourself?
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, you're the new editor-in-chief of Prosper magazine. Is Prosper a Mac shop or a PC shop?
We use both, but I use a Mac, and most of the production people all use Macintoshes, of course. So we're sort of agnostic that way. It just, we need to get the job done, whatever it takes.
Why did you take this job?
Well, I think this is a fabulous opportunity. I mean, really, the region that Sacramento anchors is growing faster than any other part of California. In fact, I've heard it referred to as the third California, which is the sort of not the coastal area. People are flocking to this area. It's where all the growth in California is due to happen. It's where jobs are still being created at a higher clip than any other part of the country or the state. And so I think there's a real chance to tell this story. Prosper has a chance to tell a business story in business stories of people and their success in a way that never has been told in this region, to try to get at the roots of what prosperity is all about. And in fact, in a lot of ways, what we're trying to aim for is something much bigger than the traditional vision of what prosperity is. Originally, you might have thought prosperity was about wealth. We don't think that's the case any longer. We think, you know, life is about balance these days, and there are three components to it in most people's lives. There's a work component, there's a living component, and there's a giving back component. And we think that you can only prosper by succeeding in all three of those areas. We think there are a lot of stories to be told of people who are doing that. So that's what I'm really excited by, is the chance to tell those stories.
When Prosper started up about 2 years ago, it seemed to me to be pretty much a business magazine. Since the magazine is expanding its focus, why did they hire you with all your business journalism experience to lead that expansion?
Well, because where we're really going is an expansion from business. We're trying to take business, and business is a tough word to use. It turns off as many people, I think, as turns on. We're trying to move beyond what originally a business magazine might have been. I worked at Forbes for many years. And our vision at Forbes was very much about wealth and about, you know, sort of the personalities of entrepreneurs. That's really where we want to go. We want to expand into the area of profiling entrepreneurs, people who are trying to do things, and lessons they've learned as well as challenges they've overcome. We're looking to give people ideas as to how they can maybe succeed, how they can rethink their lives. And to a certain extent, a lot of this is about people rethinking their lives. Many people move out here, I think, to get away from the Bay Area or from Los Angeles, to get away from that rat race, to think their life, to put their children in schools that they think are better, to live a more enjoyable life, to maybe get off the rat race a little bit, and yet still be successful. Technology allows people to live almost anywhere now and do their business. So we think that there are a lot of stories like that and a lot of people who share in this vision. And so we think that there's really a chance to do that. And I think starting from a business point of view is the right way to do it.
There's been a lot of turnover at Prosper. The magazine's first publisher resigned early this year, and a few months ago, Prosper's editor, your predecessor, and the chief operating officer left. Does all this change equal turmoil? Is Prosper in trouble?
No, I don't think so. Actually, I think it's in a stronger position than it's ever been in. We're starting to really attack and drive into the marketplace that we need to be in. We're not trying to compete with or be the same as other magazines. I think maybe that was a problem in the past. We're not looking to do that. We're trying to build something new, something that is inspirational to people, and trying to give people a real chance to see themselves in a mirror, and maybe see some ways that they could change themselves and change their lives.
Almost every publication is having a tough time navigating its way through the internet, because there's a need to have a viable presence on the internet. At the same time, revenues from internet publishing have not come close to equaling what those revenues have displaced in the print side. How can a two-year-old magazine based in Sacramento overcome that?
Well, you're absolutely right. The internet is a crucial part of anybody's media strategy these days. I started a publication online called Forbes.com in the late 90s. We were one of the pioneers of business on the internet, and it was a pretty extraordinary experience. And while it took us a while to figure out exactly the revenue stream and our audience, we were successful with it. I believe you can be successful, but I don't think you can be successful by repurposing the same material that you publish in the pages of the magazine. You have to find ways to build new services, new features, new elements that you can give to your readers that are supplementary, not the same as the things that are published in the magazine. I think one of the problems with many media companies is they're very good at producing, whether it's a story or an article or whatever it is, and they think that, well, we'll just put that same stuff on the web. I don't think that does anything to you. I mean, why would you go? The web is a different experience. You're looking for different things there. Maybe it's a more interactive thing. Maybe it's a chance to react, to talk to other readers, to have a dialogue, to use blogs, to use various elements where you can have some kind of insight and some kind of interaction. Interaction, I think, is the key. I think you have to think outside the box a little bit. And I think that many media companies have not done that. And so they've struggled to find any kind of advertising support. And it's really the advertising support's based on the number of eyeballs that are there. If people come, if people are engaged, if they're talking, if they're making comments, if they're doing things, I think the advertisers will be there. And I think that's really what it comes down to. But you're absolutely right. You cannot do a media company today without an internet strategy. It's absolutely crucial.
But doesn't what you're describing amount to publishing the equivalent of 1.5 magazines on the revenues of one?
Maybe, but I think there are other kinds of revenue sources that are available. There are sponsorships. There are, you know, that you can have partnerships. You can have joint ventures. There are, you know, you have to think in a different way, I think, rather than just thinking banner ads and thinking, that sort of in a traditional sense. I think you have to think beyond that, and you have to look at different things. For instance, one of the things I think that's very powerful on the web and that can be developed and is being developed by several companies in this area are local programming. Very local programming, whether that's high school sports or whether that's local communities and neighborhoods. I think that, you know, where there are many ways to change the way that what you deliver, whereas what we may deliver in a magazine needs to be pan-regional, needs to be of interest to people all the way from Tahoe to Vacaville and from, let's say, Modesto to Chico. I think, you know, on a web, you can do an area just around Oak Ridge High School. You can just have something that's specific to that. You can let people discuss the things that they care about in their local community. So I think that, you know, it's really about how smart you are and how intelligent you are in framing the kinds of things that readers will be interested in. Also, of course, it's also about adjusting. Very important thing that I think people forget about the web is that you have to adjust it. At Forbes.com, we rewrote and recreated the site within the first year 3 times because we realized we weren't hitting the people we wanted to. It wasn't really addressing the needs of people who were getting there. We eventually got it right. Today, the site's the 4th most visited business site in the world. Well, I think the same thing with whatever we do. We'll take a stab. We'll put some stuff together. We'll put it out there, and we'll adjust it. We'll make it better, and over time, we'll get it right.
Jeffrey Young, the new editor-in-chief of Prosper Magazine. Jeffrey, thanks so much for coming in today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, once a dining rest stop between the Bay Area and Tahoe, Sacramento now has a lively restaurant scene. Two food critics give us local restaurant trends and tips when we return. Listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Updating a previous show, last Tuesday we looked at the impact Indian casinos in California are having on the economy of northern Nevada. Conrad, a listener in Reno, emailed us to say that a key difference between Nevada gaming and Indian casino gaming is regulation. He wrote, "In Nevada, we've had very strict regulation in the industry, which allows for an equal playing field among each casino. Indian gaming, on the other hand, is no-holds-barred gaming," he writes, "where each property can do essentially whatever they want. Since they're sovereign nations, nobody except the tribes themselves can do anything about it." Just 10 years ago, parking your car in the evening in downtown Sacramento was usually pretty easy. Now it's a challenge, and one of the main reasons for that is the growth in quantity and quality of restaurants in the central city. We're going to take a close look at Sacramento and its region's dining scene, which are the places to go to, which restaurants are heading up and which are heading down, and just how good is Sacramento's dining scene overall. Two local food critics join us. They're Mike Dunn of the Sacramento Bee and Kate Washington of the Sacramento News and Review. Mike is his paper's food editor and restaurant critic. 2 days ago, the Bee published his annual list of Sacramento's best restaurants. Kate is her paper's restaurant critic and is a freelance food and travel writer. In September, Kate's piece about Sacramento's dining boom was a News and Review cover story. Kate, Mike, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike, in the past, you've listed your favorite restaurants in order, but in your latest list, you listed them in alphabetical order. Why didn't you come out and say which restaurant you think was the best this year?
Basically, because I felt that there was such a small difference between a restaurant that might be rated number one and a restaurant that might be number 10, or in this case, number 12, that gap is so narrow these days that it's just sort of lost its significance. I'd like to feel that all 12 restaurants on that list are pretty equal in those standards that I look for in a restaurant, and that it was really difficult, almost impossible for me to single out anyone as the best.
Nevertheless, if you had to, would you feel comfortable saying which one out of those 12 is overall the best?
It's ironic that it turned out this way, but if I were to single out one restaurant as the best in Sacramento or the Sacramento area, it again would be Biba, which even alphabetically is right at the top of the list.
Yes. Kate, you don't do a list like this, but if you were, what restaurant would you put at the top of your list?
I'm not sure that I would be comfortable giving one favorite. I review a wide range of styles of restaurants, from cheap eats on up to fine dining, so that makes it more difficult because they have different standards. I can tell you where I go when I'm not working for, say, you know, a celebration dinner,
sure.
And that's often the Waterboy.
Yes.
So.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, how you evaluate different kinds of restaurants, because it's like a movie reviewer, you know, comparing, a comedy to a serious film. Kate, how do you create standards to evaluate different kinds of restaurants that have nothing to do with each other?
What I typically try to do is evaluate whether they're successful at what they're aiming to do. If a taqueria is trying to make a great taco, I evaluate whether they're doing that and not whether they have, you know, crisply starched white tablecloths and napkins, you know, whereas a fine dining restaurant is aiming for a different level of service. And, you know, there I might take into account decor, menu, presentation of the food, and, you know, whether all the food is well executed at the same time. It's just a different set of standards, restaurant by restaurant, I would say.
Does that mean that a taqueria could be the equal of Biba because it does what it's trying to do as well as Biba's trying to do, does what it's trying to do?
I don't think it's the equal of Biba. I wouldn't put it in quite those terms, but I would say that if what you want is to go out for tacos, then I can, you know, direct somebody perhaps to a good place to do that. And if what somebody wants to do is go out for an elegant Northern Italian meal, they would perhaps be directed to Biba.
Yeah. So. Mike, how do you handle evaluating restaurants that are not even trying, not even close to trying to do the same thing?
Yeah, for the most part, my assignment is we have two restaurant critics at the Sacramento Bee, and one focuses on more casual places, say the taquerias. And I'm to focus primarily on special occasion white tablecloth restaurants. But even so, I'll do occasional columns where I'll focus on more casual Thai restaurants or Mexican restaurants, Japanese restaurants. And I'll approach each one on its own terms, looking at what its goals are, the context that it is striving for. The consistent standards would be basically, you know, how clean the place is, what the service is like, the creativity of the food, and how steady the execution is, how congenial, amiable the service is. Yeah. And but beyond that, each restaurant, I think, regardless of style, has to be judged on its own goals, its own basis.
Mike, you said that that if pushed, you'd probably put Biba as the first among equals among your restaurants. Is that a sign of the strength or the weakness of Sacramento's dining scene that Biba is so dominant after all these years?
I think it's a sign of the strength of Biba, the restaurant, and Biba Caggiano, the person, and her presence on site almost every night, her dedication to continually upgrading the menu, upgrading the service, the devotion of her staff. I don't think it's a reflection at all of the weakness of the Sacramento dining scene. It's she's aware of the competition and has continually tried successfully to continually upgrade the restaurant and make adjustments when there have been weaknesses.
Kate, do you have any thoughts on that?
I would agree with Mike. I would say she's somebody I talked to pretty extensively for the story I did on Sacramento's dining scene. It was very interesting to speak with her about, you know, her views on other restaurants that are coming up, on, you know, where she enjoys going out to eat as well as the strength of the continuing strength of her restaurant.
Well, you just mentioned in talking with Biba Caggiano, and your story about the state of Sacramento's restaurant scene started with Biba Caggiano's memories of local dining options in the late 60s. Remind us of how things were then in Sacramento, according to Biba.
Well, she talked a bit about going out to places that called themselves Continental, and where things were, you know, where you were presented with the half of a lemon wrapped in gauze, and but not a particularly authentic style of food, you know, nothing, things that she didn't perhaps recognize as, you know, coming from, you know, Italy, if she went out to an Italian
or
meal.
Italian,
yes,
she said, yes,
as some well-meaning neighbors of hers, I believe, referred to it. So she talked about being, you know, quite disappointed in the level of local dining. So
was that Sacramento, or was that really more how things pretty much were in America at that time?
No, I think you've had cities, of course, New Orleans, New York, Los Angeles, certainly San Francisco, that back in the 60s and 70s were very progressive, very accomplished dining communities. And I think Sacramento has had a large portion of its population has been fairly conservative when it comes to dining out. When they did want to go to out to eat on a special occasion for an anniversary or birthday, the proximity of San Francisco was where they would take advantage of that, and that's where they would go. And that might have restrained development and evolution of fine dining in Sacramento for several years.
Let's talk a bit more about that. When you think about all the prime farmland to the north, south, east, and west of Sacramento, you've got to ask yourself why the city hadn't always had a strong culinary history and culture and reputation. Kate, why do you think that didn't happen?
I think to some degree, Mike put his finger on it in saying that it's been a conservative local scene to some extent. I think a lot of the you know, wonderful local produce that's being grown around here and made around here is shipped down to the Bay Area. So there's something to that as well. I think government towns often have a reputation for conservatism and, you know, in social matters, and that's possibly one aspect of that.
Mike, let's talk a little bit more about your list that was published the other day in the paper. I went to last year's list, and several restaurants on last year's top 10 are not on this year's top 12, and they are The Firehouse, Le Billig, French Café, Dawson's American Bistro and Martinis, Paragary's Bar and Oven, and Luca Restaurant and Bar. That's a pretty big drop-off. What happened?
Well, I think in some of those instances, say the Firehouse and Dawson's are two that come to mind, I think that they have slipped somewhat. I think they're still very good restaurants, but the consistency that I look for and the excitement that I look for weren't there in those cases and some other cases. But it wasn't so much that they had fallen dramatically as that the other restaurants that are on the list have continued to improve. They're steady to me by my experiences, and I go back to all these restaurants at least once every year, have just provided more punch, more excitement. They were offering new things, doing new things. That might be a prefix menu, could be an expanded wine list, it could be more training of staff. They just raised the bar a bit.
Kate, have you eaten in any of those restaurants in the last year? And if so, have you noticed any slippage?
I can't say that I have, actually. Okay. Or not often enough to comment on, directly on that.
Okay. Mike, you said in your article, in one of your articles, that Paragary's Bar and Oven seemed to be more now of a neighborhood restaurant rather than a destination restaurant. That seems like an unfortunate slip for a restaurant that was so famous in Sacramento.
Yes, well, it's I think
it doesn't see itself that way, I would suspect.
Probably not, but my feeling, my impression was that it still has some terrific servers there. Some of the food is still a lot of fun, accomplished. I enjoy it. But the overall impression was that it had relaxed its standards, its attitudes. It was not striving like it had at an earlier point in its life.
The Firehouse and Paragary's have been around for a long, long time, but Luca is a fairly new place. It went into your top 10 and then dropped out of the top 12. That seems like an unusual trajectory for a new restaurant.
Again, I think it's a matter of other restaurants just coming up a notch or two rather than there being any significant slip in Luca.
Yeah. Earlier, Kate, you talked about how you have a personal preference for the Waterboy. What is it you like about the Waterboy?
I like the freshness of the flavors, the fact that they're using a lot of local ingredients in a changing and inventive menu. They're often offering things that you don't see on a lot of Sacramento menus. Sweetbreads, I remember going there once and having a kind of bolito misto that had, I believe it was lamb tongue, that was absolutely delicious in it. That was a fall dinner, you know, it was perfect for kind of a chilly, drizzly night. They have, in my experience, always very professional, very accomplished servers, and it's a very comfortable, pleasant place to be. I think that's, you know, what I enjoy about it.
For people who haven't been to the Waterboy, what kind of restaurant is it? How would you describe it?
I would describe it as New American with Mediterranean, primarily French influences.
And let's talk about New American. What does that mean, New American cuisine?
Well, that's a slippery term, I would say, actually. I use it for convenience sake because it's widely used kind of in the food world. But it would, and Mike can maybe chime in and or correct me, but I think it would indicate a style of cooking that's emphasizing local, seasonal, fresh cooking that uses some American flavors but updates them, updates the style on the plate.
Might take a traditional American dish like meatloaf and tweak it, twist it, put new ingredients in it. And also, I think New American has a pretty international scope perspective. It takes ingredients and techniques from Southeast Asia, from countries in Europe other than France and Italy, and incorporates those in the cooking, as well as from South America and any place in the world.
How you've both described new American cuisine sounds an awful lot like how I've heard California cuisine described. Is California cuisine a subset of new American cuisine, or is this something I'm not getting
here? I
would
agree that it is. I think California cuisine has a definite emphasis on local, seasonal, organic, more so than maybe new American cuisine might have.
Mm. Kate, are there any other restaurants that you would add to the top group, whether it's 10, 12, 5, or whatever, in Sacramento that we haven't yet mentioned?
Gosh, there are many that we haven't directly mentioned. Some of the perhaps recent openings that I think are worth a visit, 55 Degrees, Mulvaney's Building and Loan is always interesting and offering some different flavors that change very frequently. Mason's American Cooking in the Park Downtown Complex. I'm sure there are others.
Okay. Mike, what do you think about those restaurants?
Yeah, I think, 55 Degrees was on the top 12 list, and Mulvaney's was on the top 12 list. And there are certainly one thing that I have done in the past with my year-end list that I didn't do this year primarily because of space considerations, was that I always had a list of contenders or ones that could have been in the top 10 or the top 12 very, very easily. And I would include mention of Luca. You mentioned Luca would mm-hmm. certainly have been one. Le Billig up in Auburn, Aioli, Bidwell Street Bistro in Folsom are all really strong, fun, exciting restaurants that people, I don't think that they will disappoint anyone who goes there.
My guests are Mike Dunn, food editor and restaurant critic at the Sacramento Bee, and Kate Washington, restaurant critic for the Sacramento News and Review. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, more on Sacramento and its region's dining scene. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow, we'll update you on some of the people and stories we covered in 2006, including California's bullet train ambition and a West Sacramento man who's now a government minister in Liberia. And later this week, you'll hear from breast cancer survivor Dina Howard, and we'll look back at the movies of 2006. Our topic today is Sacramento's dining scene. Our guests are restaurant critics Kate Washington of the Sacramento News and Review and Mike Dunn of the Sacramento Bee. Mike, you had another thought about Sacramento's agricultural milieu.
Right. You raised the question about why Sacramento hasn't seemed to develop a cuisine of its own, even though it is surrounded by this vast agricultural valley. And I've wondered about that, too. And I think it's because so much of the farming has been large-scale corporate farming. And whether it be canning tomatoes or asparagus, a lot of this just gets, as Kate pointed out, shipped off elsewhere. And there hasn't really been a culture of chefs and restaurateurs until fairly recently that have started to look in their backyard to see what they could find and take advantage of. And at the same time, we are now seeing this rise in the number of small family farms, or the revival of small family farms, especially in Yolo County, but also in the Sierra foothills, and even in Sacramento, that are coming up with specialty crops, different kinds of heirloom tomatoes, heirloom squashes, all kinds of lettuces and so forth. And there are these farmers and the restaurateurs are coming together to support each other. And I think it is just starting to give an incentive and reason and rise to a cuisine that is very regional, very local, and will be very exciting to watch develop over the next couple of years.
Kate, you talked about this in your September story for the News and Review, about the the apparent lack of a distinctive cuisine in Sacramento. Is there anything that you see in your visits to restaurants that seem to be typically Sacramento in some way or another in its restaurant or dining scene?
I don't really know that there is one thing. I mean, you hear often talk of Sacramento as a sort of meat and potatoes town, and there's been, you know, talk about that in the last years, you know, that I think often what's on the center of the plate, the protein, is still, you know, on the conservative side, and that's fairly typical of Sacramento restaurants. At the same time, one of the really interesting developments that's coming up and that I think is percolating up to fine dining establishments is this enormous boom of different ethnic restaurants opened by the really vastly diverse group of immigrants to Sacramento. There are, you know, fabulous restaurants of that sort of in the Cheap Eats variety all over town, and that those interesting and very vibrant flavors are making their way into fine dining establishments and becoming, you know, really far more acceptable to local palates because of that.
Mike, if you were talking to a colleague who's never been to Sacramento, how would you describe the local dining scene?
Increasingly diverse, increasingly inventive, a little bit more daring, the kinds of foods that you see at the Waterboy, Sweetbreads, and some other restaurants that might be serving tripe or foie gras at 55 degrees. You wouldn't have seen this a few years ago, and you're seeing more and more of that. So it's becoming more cosmopolitan, more just more sophisticated and a little more adventurous.
Well, both of you, if you had a guest from a very cosmopolitan city, let's say someone who's a fine dining connoisseur from Paris or New York and they're visiting for the first time, what restaurant would you take them to in Sacramento that you think would show off Sacramento's dining scene to best effect? Mike?
Well, I think three restaurants that come to mind, one would be Biba, one would be the Waterboy, and Lemongrass.
Okay. And Kate, where would you take this person?
I find it hard to disagree with those. I might add, depending on the city and the tastes of the person, you know, I might take them to 55 degrees if we wanted, you know, a great lunch in a sort of hip, modern setting, something like that. So.
Earlier, Kate, you talked about Cheap Eats, and you do cover quite a range of restaurant prices in your work for the Sacramento News and Review. Give us a couple of your favorite restaurants that are on the more affordable range.
One of my favorite places to stop for lunch whenever I'm in the neighborhood is Hoang Lan, which is a Vietnamese banh mi sandwich shop at 65th Street. And there you can get an absolutely delicious grilled pork sandwich and a you know, mocha tapioca pearl drink, all for under $5 for lunch. So that's you know, a great deal.
And is that 65th and Folsom?
Yes,
part of that new development.
Oh no, I'm sorry, not 65th and Folsom. Down down behind Florin.
I see. Okay.
So I misspoke. And you know, the La Fiesta restaurants, the taquerias are always always tasty. I recently went to Alonzo's Coffee Shop for breakfast, where you can get a great sort of Mexican style breakfast of chorizo and eggs. And
where's Alonzo's?
That's in the Fruit Ridge Shopping Center.
Okay.
So South Sacramento is a great area to explore for Cheap Eats.
Indeed. And Mike, you mainly cover the fine dining range, but which places do you like on the more affordable end?
I like the Vietnamese pho shops, whether they be on Broadway or Stockton Boulevard. I'm always looking around for Mexican restaurants that I can write about, Thai restaurants. They're all over the place, and I always find them, almost always find them real consistent, high value. And again, I'm looking for some of those that I can write about.
Mm. How often do the staff members in a restaurant know who you are when you walk in the door, Kate?
I hope not very often. To my knowledge, I've never had somebody tip me that they've recognized me. I try to keep a pretty low profile, but it may happen. So,
Mike, has it ever happened to you?
Yes, it happens, or I suspect that it happens, even if it's not obvious. Probably these days, a third of the time.
How do you deal with that? Because how do we know that we're going to get the same experience that Mike Dunn or Kate Washington get?
Right. Well, when I suspect that I've been identified or know that I have, I will keep perhaps a closer eye than usual on the size portions that other guests receive and the kind of service that they are getting as well, and order foods that can't be doctored much at the last minute. There are foods that have been largely prepared earlier in the day, except for some last-minute garnishing.
Assuming that the papers you work for pick up the tab when you're working, where do you choose to eat when you're personally responsible for the bill, Mike?
Okay. Well, probably the one place where we would frequent when we're not working, when I'm not working, is probably tend to gravitate toward the Waterboy, Centro, that 28th and J, the Mexican restaurant there. And part of this has to do with living in the Midtown area and just liking to be able to walk to find restaurants as opposed to driving any distance.
Kate, what about you?
Yeah, well, I spoke to the Waterboy earlier. Enjoy Mulvaney's Building and Loan, and when we don't have a babysitter for our toddler, we go to more casual places. Like to take her out to breakfast at, say, Cafe Bernardo. I don't live in Midtown, but in East Sacramento, and I too like to be able to walk to places. There's Thai restaurants within walking distance of my house, and some taco places that we like to go as well. So.
Speaking of, as much as I'm not crazy about driving, one thing on the local dining scene that has changed this past year to a certain extent is the rise of really fine restaurants in outlying communities. In Winters, Monticello Bistro, in Plymouth, Taste, in Auburn, Carpe Vino, in Cameron Park, Redbud Cafe. And I think this is well for the area to see primarily younger, talented chefs coming into the area and not necessarily settling in downtown Midtown, but are still doing pretty exciting things in pretty rural areas.
Kate, is Sacramento, in particular downtown Midtown, overbuilt now with restaurants?
I think that remains to be seen, actually. Some of the restaurateurs I've talked to have spoken a bit about downtown being a bit saturated for now, and it will depend on whether the residents come in to those areas who can support those restaurants, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday night. I think, they can draw in the patrons for the weekend nights, but those weekday, dining audiences need to come from people in the area, like, as Mike said, who can walk to a local restaurant. So
yes,
that depends a lot on what happens next.
Mike, would you be concerned if a lot more restaurants opened downtown and Midtown?
No, I wouldn't be concerned. My concern is that not that it's becoming saturated with restaurants and opportunities to eat out, as the increase in property values and rents might discourage the independent operator from coming in and might open up the opportunity for more chains to become concentrated in downtown and Midtown. And I just have a personal preference to seeing more independently owned and operated restaurants.
Mm-hmm. And we just have about a minute left, so I'll ask you just quickly, either to tell us what you're most looking forward to next year in Sacramento's dining scene or what the next restaurant you'll review will be. Kate?
Well, as far as things I'm looking forward to, I'm very interested to try the new place, Roxy, and to see what happens with the Selin's new place, Ella's, which is going to be downtown. and see what else opens up. Lots of wine bars coming up that should be interesting, and see what's on the horizon.
Mike?
Yeah, I'm looking at this, the latter half of this year, the momentum of restaurants opening kind of tapered off. It was pretty dull the last half of 2006. It looks like things are going to pick up in the first half of 2007. I'm also looking forward very much to reviewing Roxy. I'm about to review Monticello Bistro in Winters. And I think it's going to be overall a pretty interesting year next year.
Well, thank you so much. Kate Washington of the Sacramento News and Review and Mike Dunn of the Sacramento Bee. Thanks both.
Thank you.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Our associate producer today was Natalie Breen. Insight staff includes technical director Mark Jones, assistant producer Jen Picard, and senior producer Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us. California's bullet train ambitions to the plight of small alternative radio stations in our region. We've covered a great range of topics on Insight this year. A great range of people, too, like the West Sacramento man who's now a government minister in Liberia. Next time at Insight, we'll update you on these and other topics and people we covered in 2006. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow at 2 on the KXJZ stations.